This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Cold War is over, yet Germany and other European countries are besieged with troubles. Germans are trying to cope with the high cost of reunification while being hit with the worst recession in decades. Why is Europe in such a shambles now? It's a question we put to Craig Whitney, European diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. He's been with the paper for 25 years and has been bureau chief in Saigon, in Bonn, Moscow, Washington, and London. He's also the author of a new book, Spy Trader, about Wolfgang Vogel and the shadowy world of Cold War espionage. I asked him what hopes Germany had when the wall came down.
Unrealistic ones. I think they thought that Eastern Germany, the formerly communist part, could be quickly absorbed into West Germany, that prosperity would instantly arrive in the eastern part of the country, and that the West could do all this without having to do any heavy breathing. And none of that, of course, has turned out to be the case.
Would you say the country is experiencing a kind of identity crisis today because of the differences between the two Germanies? Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say it's an identity crisis, but I think what has clearly emerged is that East Germany and West Germany had developed into two very separate cultures, which will take years, probably decades, to meld, and that the United Germany is something very different from just an expanded version of what we knew as West Germany during the Cold War.
Well, how would you say these two former sides view each other?
Well, to make a cliche out of it, as they often do, it's the Wessis are the people in Western Germany, and they tend, to, if we oversimplify a bit, to view the Ossies, the people in the East, as lazy, don't know what work is, think that everything should be served up to them on a platter, at their expense. And the Ossies in the East think of the West Germans as overbearing, rich uncles who are a bit stingy and don't want to sacrifice anything to let them have a little piece of the good life that they've enjoyed for 40 years.
Any truth to the cliches?
Sure. I think the only way to overcome these cliches is for national leadership in the country to recognize that people have to be told what realities are and not lied to. I would fault Chancellor Kohl for having misled people back in 1990 by saying to both East and West, this is going to be a piece of cake, nobody's going to be worse off, and nobody's going to have to make any sacrifices. And what he should have made, in the view of people like one of his predecessors, former Chancellor Helmut Schmidt, is a blood, sweat, and tears speech along the lines of Churchill's at the beginning of World War II, telling people, look, this is a great accomplishment. Unification is the realization of a long-term dream that we've had. But it's going to take a lot of hard work, and probably means that we in the West are going to have to give up some guaranteed annual benefits and annual increases in salaries and that sort of thing for a number of years so that our less well-off cousins in the East can eventually enjoy the same standard of living we do.
So are Germany's economic troubles, which are growing, tied then with the problems of reunification?
Certainly, they are in the eastern part of the country, and that $100 billion drain is there for the West. But what has really hit them hard on top of all this is the recession spread from the United States and Britain and other parts of Western Europe into Western Germany over this past year. So they're having to cope with this burden of unification at the same time as they're hit by the worst recession since the end of the World War II.
Has this recession hit Germany harder than France or England or any of the other European countries?
No, it's hit them less hard than France or England, but the Germans aren't used to unemployment of more than 3 million people. And It's not just maybe a short-term problem. What is happening in Germany today is sort of what happened to the United States in the 1980s in the steel industry, for instance, or the coal mining industry. These are high-cost industries in countries like the United States and Germany, and the competition from countries where labor is cheaper and the benefits that workers get are less extensive than they are in our countries, puts Germany at a competitive disadvantage, maybe forever. I don't know if Germany will continue making steel beyond the 1990s, but it's not something the Germans are used to concede that a whole area of industry, which has been a mainstay of their country's economic welfare for, you know, a century, might just have to wither away and cede to cheaper competition from Eastern Europe and East Asia.
My guest is Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. We're talking about Germany, and I should add that he's also the author of a new book called Spy Trader. Well, until July 1st of this year, Germany had a rather lenient immigration policy. Until recently, why were they so open to outsiders?
Mm-hmm. They didn't have a lenient immigration policy. They had no immigration policy. What they had that was lenient by international standards was asylum. Asylum, you could claim asylum in Germany if you got there and simply told the immigration authorities the minute you arrived, I want to claim asylum. Under the German practice and law up to last July, anybody could do this, and last year nearly 450,000 people did. Now, not everybody who's coming in was really able to claim political persecution or religious or racial persecution. A lot of people were just fleeing from bad economic conditions in South Asia, Southeast Europe, and so on. The Germans saw this as an abuse of their liberal asylum procedures. The problem, as you mentioned when you assumed that it was a liberal immigration procedure that they had, is that the Germans don't allow anybody to immigrate except ethnic Germans. And there's a debate going on in the country now that perhaps they ought to change that and at least, to a limited extent, give some people the possibility of becoming Germans. For instance, Turks who've lived there for 30 or 40 years and whose children have never lived in Turkey and who only speak German, shouldn't they have the right to be German citizens if they want to?
And is this an issue that's being discussed?
Yeah,
inside the country?
It's being discussed in the public realm. It hasn't yet got to the point of anybody formulating a bill to debate in Parliament, but the Germans recognize that they have a major problem. But this immigration problem was, and still is, a terrific one. I mean, we tend to read about the right-wing backlash against it, the extremist violence against foreigners that has gone on, partly as a result of these overwhelming numbers. There's no excuse for that, but the Germans have received, when we consider last year alone, 450,000 asylum seekers. Well, that's way, way beyond what any other European country does. And all they've done now is really brought their asylum procedures in line with those of Britain, the United States, and other Western countries.
You mentioned the right-wing backlash, and there certainly have been attacks on foreigners, some very violent attacks that have ended in actual murders. Why the increase? And I'm assuming that there is an increase on attacks on foreigners in Germany.
Well, the increase has paralleled directly those big numbers in asylum seekers that we've seen. And that has risen from, say, 100,000 a few years ago, or less even, to 450,000 last year. I think it also has to do, the violence has to do with the recession, with the unemployment. There are lots of unemployed people out there today, particularly in East Germany, but not only there, also in the western part of the country, where people think they don't have a future, they'll never get a job. What are all these foreigners doing here? They're taking jobs away from us. That's not true. The foreigners who came seeking asylum, most of them aren't allowed to work. But that's what some of these poor and frustrated and maybe less well-educated Germans thought. And then, well, you get a couple of beers into you at night and think, let's go make trouble or scare the asylum seekers.
There are neo-Nazis and there are skinheads in Germany, just the way there are in other countries, including the United States. Do you think they're any more dangerous in Germany because of its fascist past?
Well, we do worry more about Germany because of its fascist past, certainly, but I don't think history repeats itself exactly the same way every time. That's not to say that I want to minimize this neo-Nazi threat. The Germans should take the laws they have on the books seriously, and those laws forbid the emulation of Nazi methods or ideas or the dissemination of those ideas. You can't even buy Mein Kampf in Germany because it's against the law. But in many cases, judges have tended to hand out rather lenient sentences against troublemakers who've committed acts of violence against foreigners. Some of the sentences were, 6 months or probation. I think it takes some more strict law enforcement. When these things happen, they should be dealt with more firmly and more concerted action by the government to discredit these right-wing groups when they do try to blame foreigners for what's happening. Then we won't have a repetition of the Weimar Republic years, and I don't think that we are in the Weimar Republic again in Germany in the 1990s.
Are some of these far-right extremist political groups gaining in popularity in Germany? Beyond the youth?
There is a party called the Republikaner, the Republicans, although my Republican friends in the United States don't like to hear the word used for understandable reasons. This party is not one that's been outlawed. It denies that it's a neo-Nazi party, but it's on the extreme right wing of acceptable politics in Germany today. And that one has made some gains in state and local elections in recent years. We'll see what happens in the national election the fall of next year or late part of next year. But in no case has this support gone above 10%. And I think historically, if you look at West German politics for the last 50 years, at times of economic hardship and strain, there's always been a right-wing potential of about 10%. And we always worry about it, and we should, but it hasn't ever gone beyond 10%. I would doubt that it would go even that far in the next national elections, but that depends on what happens between now and then.
Well, I want to pick up on some of those ideas, but first I want to take just a very short break. And my guest today on Fresh Air is Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. He's also the author of a new book just come out called Spy Traitor. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Craig Whitney, and he's the New York Times European diplomatic correspondent. Well, let's enlarge our conversation to include all of Europe. And what has happened to the efforts to work towards European unity? Where is that today?
It's in a huge moral crisis, I would say. The effort to spur European unity and make it to arrive at the day when we had European unity faster began after German unification in 1990, and it went too fast. They tried to point the way towards monetary and economic union and buttress the goal of political union in the treaty they signed at Maastricht, the Netherlands, at the end of 1991. And I think they went too fast. The recession made it impossible to meld the German, French, British, Spanish economies as fast as would be necessary to get to monetary union by the end of this decade, and as a result, they may not. And under the strain, I think they've lost their bearings, and they don't really see where they're going now. One of the first things they promised to do was agree on a common foreign policy, and immediately that fell apart over the issue of Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm wondering, is it even reasonable to expect that countries could put aside old rivalries and nationalistic tendencies and local economic concerns to act as a unified economic force?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think the great accomplishment of the European community, and it's certainly undiminished, is it's hard to think of any conceivable circumstance in which France, Britain, and Germany would be at war with each other. And I don't think they've fallen back on that accomplishment. But what is very hard is to make a single economy and a single political entity out of countries with centuries-long traditions of their own, of independence, of different languages and legal structures and all kinds of differences. It just isn't as easy as it was to build the United States, and it wasn't that easy for us to build the United States. We forget that now. The issue of monetary union is fundamentally a political issue. Margaret Thatcher pointed that out years ago, that if you agree to have a common money, then you're really giving up a basic element of sovereignty in your country, which is, you know, the right to issue your own coin and decide what it should be worth. And that issue has been much more difficult to cope with for the Europeans than they thought when they signed the Maastricht Treaty 3 years ago.
Let's talk a little bit about Bosnia. Why do you think Europe has been so reluctant to get involved with the war in what was the former Yugoslavia?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wouldn't just say Europe. Why have we been so reluctant, too?
But it's in their backyard, so to speak.
It is in their backyard, but it's a war that wasn't of their making. I think we could sympathize with Europeans who don't want to send troops into a civil war situation whose causes are obscure to them and the outcome of which is highly uncertain. Sending combat troops into a situation like that could involve heavy casualties on the part of every country whose forces got involved in fighting there. That's why the United States doesn't want to send in ground troops. That's why the Europeans don't. The trouble is that if you don't want to do that, then you've got to come up with other ways of stabilizing the situation or preventing it from spreading in your own interest. And the Europeans have not succeeded in doing that. Nothing that the Europeans have done has deterred that kind of conflict, and it could arise in other parts of the former communist world unless we do find a way to deter it. So there's been a general admission, I think, by the Europeans of failure in their current policies. As a substitute for deterrence or intervention, what they've done is sent in troops under the UN aegis to carry out humanitarian missions. These troops, however, have become hostage to the violence. They can't prevent it or stop it, but they're there. One of the arguments going on now is that if NATO starts bombing Bosnian Serb targets, as it threatened to do at the end of July, earlier in August, then if the Serbs want to retaliate, they've got troops from France and Britain in the UN forces that they could start shooting if they chose. And so these humanitarian missions become hostages to violence.
Do you think, though, that Europe or particular countries in Europe are going to make a move, whether it's a move militarily or to increase the number of at least peacekeeping forces in Bosnia?
I don't. I mean, I think they all clearly hope that the fighting will stop. The Muslims will recognize their defeat by agreeing to some sort of negotiated solution. We'll probably have a UN presence in Bosnia for the rest of this century, certainly, to keep people from resuming the fighting once it does stop.
So they'll do nothing, is what you're saying, or nothing more than what they've already done?
That's right. I don't really believe that NATO is ever going to bomb there either. I'll believe it when I see the first bomb on its way down to the ground.
You think it's a mistake?
I don't know. I think it's one of a thousand mistakes that we've all made. The important thing is to learn from these mistakes and think, what can we do to prevent this horrible sort of situation from arising elsewhere, in Moldova, say, or between the Ukraine and Russia, or in the Baltics, in Azerbaijan, in Nagorno-Karabakh. There's plenty of trouble spots in the former communist world, and they all involve clashing ethnic or national interests, just as they do in Yugoslavia. And we've got to find a way, the world community does, to make sure that never again does it result in this kind of bloody conflict that we've seen in Nagorno-Karabakh and in Bosnia.
I'm wondering, and I realize you're not a diplomat, you're a diplomatic correspondent, but how you do or how a country applies lessons from Bosnia, which are so idiosyncratic to the problems there, and apply them to Moldova or any of the other hotspots in Europe?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, first of all, one of the lessons that we've learned in this past case is that we have no diplomatic or military instruments that have the credibility that the NATO alliance had during the Cold War with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. The fact that NATO was there and had the military forces available to respond to armed attack by the Soviet Union, and that the United States was ready to go all the way to using nuclear weapons if it had to, deterred any attack. We had no attack by the Warsaw Pact on Western Europe for 40 years. So NATO never fired a shot in anger, but it was effective. You can't say that NATO has been effective in this conflict. It's had no effect at all on stopping the violence. How do we work with the Russians and others to make sure that NATO and other and the United Nations have more credibility, have more of a deterrent effect than they had in Yugoslavia? That is the question of how you organize a future security structure for all of Europe. And exactly how this will be done will probably vary from case to case, but surely it's something we need to worry and think about.
Well, thank you very much, Craig Whitney, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you.
Craig Whitney is European diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. He's got a new book about the world of Cold War espionage called Spy Traitor. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.